Hello, my name is Steve Wasserman, and you are listening to another episode of Read Me Something You Love, which follows a very simple and satisfying formula. You read something you love to me, I listen to you reading it, and then we talk. The conversation you're about to hear is with the psychoanalyst and author Josh Cohen, who has recently published with Granter a book called The Private Life, Why We Remain in the Dark, which I would wholeheartedly recommend. It's really one of my favourite reads of this year, particularly if you're a fan of people like Adam Phillips or Andrew Solomon, Mark Epstein, and also perhaps even genre-defying writers like Sebald, for example. It's just crammed with insights about the public and private and how they intersect, and some exquisite writing in there too. Which is what I'd like to think the podcast that Josh and I first recorded about a month ago contained in equal measure, but unfortunately, when I got home, I discovered a fantastic failure in my recording equipment, and a whole afternoon of reading love and conversational fireworks was lost. Very, very kindly, Josh agreed to meet up again, and this time I took three recorders with me just in case, which is, of course, how anxiety disorders originate. But it is also a record of how we step for the second time into the great pond of this Wallace Stevens poem, The Plain Sense of Things.
The Plain Sense of Things. After the leaves have fallen, we return to a plain sense of things. It is as if we had come to an end of the imagination, inanimate, in an inert savoir. It is difficult even to choose the adjective for this blank cold, this sadness without cause. The great structure has become a minor house. No turban walks across the lessened floors. The greenhouse never so badly needed paint. The chimney is 50 years old and slants to one side. A fantastic effort has failed, a repetition in a repetitiousness of men and flies. Yet, the absence of the imagination had itself to be imagined. The great pond, the plain sense of it, without reflections, leaves, mud, water like dirty glass, expressing silence of a sort, silence of a rat come out to see the great pond and its waste of the lilies. All this had to be imagined as an inevitable knowledge, required as a necessity requires.
Thank you. So, apart from remembering that we had an absolutely incredible conversation last time about this poem, I don't remember the questions I asked because they sort of came up as we read, but I do remember that I sort of started by asking you what for you was this plain sense of things. And I think I'd like to ask that again in the sense of what it is for you today. But also, the poem is called The Plain Sense of Things with that definite article, but we come to a plain sense of things.
Sure.
And I wondered what... That sort of seems significant as well.
Mm.
That what the plain sense of things was for you last time, and I can't actually remember what you said,
it might not be the same.
Might be different this time.
Mm. It's a nice point, isn't it? Because the plain sense of things seems to announce a kind of eternal state, a kind of, you know, a fundament which doesn't change in time. Whereas a plain sense of things has something more to do with an internal state. After the leaves have fallen, so we are in metaphorical territory.
But we're also in literal territory in the sense that more leaves have fallen since we last met.
They have.
Quite a few more.
Yeah, they have. It's true. We are well into autumn and... it's slippery on the streets outside. So the leaves have fallen from, I think, the mind writing and reading this poem. There's something about leaves which are a kind of emblem of lushness, fecundity. In Stephen's early poetry, there's this very rich imagery of natural abundance, which has to do with his sojourns in the Florida Keys and the sense of, you know, a very sort of lush tropical atmosphere. Here we're in the tail end, I think, of a New England autumn. And so the leaves have fallen outside, and the leaves have fallen inside because this man is quite old now. And a plain sense of things is a kind of, it's a sensibility which doesn't need the lush extravagance of language of nature anymore. It just needs to stay with, however vague it sounds, a sense of how things are once they're stripped of the facade of ornament, of, you know, the kind of decorative pleasures of landscape. This isn't something new for him. I mean, he's always been interested in wintry landscapes as a figure for the mind sort of stripped down, reduced to its essence. So I think a plain sense of things is a sense of things, a way of looking at the world, which isn't encumbered by stuff.
Yeah. And it feels there in that unadorned, congruent sort of way as something quite humble and modest and true and good in the best use of that term. And then, but then you come, he doesn't leave you in that good space for long, because it feels like, certainly towards the end of the first stanza, it feels like to me a place of gathering anxiety, the inanimate inner savoir.
Except
does that feel the same way to you? It doesn't feel as sort of letting out of breath. Ah, okay, here's the plain sense of things. Suddenly you've let out a breath, but you're in a space which is not that comfortable as the plain sense of things.
No, I think that's right. Except that I'm now remembering the first question you asked last time, which was about the as if.
Yes.
Because he doesn't say we have come to an end of the imagination. He says it is as if we have come to the end of the imagination. Now, as if is a lovely phrase here because, if you like, it's the rudimentary imaginative phrase. As long as you can say as if, you're still in the realm of the imagination. It may be an imagination which is now quite impoverished, or at least, you know, reduced to its barest essentials, but still, we're in the realm of the as if. And so we are not quite at the end of the imagination, because as long as it is as if we had got there, we haven't quite got there.
And yet if a patient had to say to you, it is as if I have come, someone who's deeply depressed, it's as if I've come to the end of my imagination, inanimate in an inert savoir, would that person not be expressing something that's quite bleak?
Yeah, sure. But don't you think that the context of speaking would in some way transform it? My mind goes to a passage I was discussing in a seminar the other day, which is a discussion of Kafka by the writer Maurice Blanchot, who I talk about quite a lot in the book. But Blanchot talks about this paradox, which is that if you write the sentence, I am unhappy, you are describing a diminution in your internal resources, and yet the act of writing the sentence increases your sense of your internal resources, so that the sentence itself becomes a kind of lie, or at least a contradiction. And although that sounds like a cute literary paradox, there is something I think really instructive about inner life, which is that as long as you can describe, and indeed as long as you can imagine your inner states, you're not quite at the bottom. And of course, we would say about the patient who expresses this kind of feeling that at least they're there. At least they have a mind and a mouth with which to say it, and indeed at least they have somebody to listen to it, mm-hmm. and they want it heard. Mm-hmm. So I think you do have this sense in both contexts, in the context of the poem and the context of the session, of the as if as being a kind of saviour. Sounds a bit messianic, but it rescues something, the as if. It ensures that there is some kind of creative power, however tired, there is some kind of creative resource that can still be drawn upon.
Mm. And the as if, I suppose, also it takes us into the inner world. I noticed, having read this poem a number of times, that, and I wonder how someone who maybe is listening to it, because of course some people will be listening to this podcast, if they heard when you read inanimate inner inert savoir, they heard in an, or if they heard inner. The word inner, which of course is such an important word for your recent book.
Yeah.
I actually counted the number of times that you've used inner. Would you like to guess how many times you've used the word inner?
I admire you for counting.
That's what I've been doing for the last 3 weeks.
I don't have a Kindle edition, 73.
You use it 73 times.
That doesn't surprise me. But.
And I wonder if maybe you could read, there's a part...
And that's not counting the cognates, right? Like internal.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's just the word inner. There's a part where you actually talk about this inner need, I suppose, to express ourselves.
Psychoanalysis works in the medium of language because it's through words that you discover fierce desire as your birthright. Words are the medium through which you both make sense of and become irremediably confused by your desires. Words may be regarded as predestined to ambiguity, as Freud writes in The Interpretation of Dreams. From his earliest to his latest writings, he insists that the failure of words to coincide with the things they name is a, if not the, central predicament of being human. You speak, as Lydia Davis shows in her story of the young woman who's really a fat old man, to externalise inner thoughts and feelings, only to discover that something, perhaps the very thing you most wanted to communicate, has been left behind in the passage from the silent matter of inner life to the noise of words. However hard you try to bring it to light, something always remains in the dark.
Mm. So that silent matter of inner life, is that the plain sense of things? Or is that something else?
I think the plain sense of things is part of it. The silent matter of inner life, I think, is everything that struggles to get into language. And I think one of the things that the poem's about is the fact that as soon as we're in language, in a way you leave the plain sense of things behind. And this is particularly true for a poet, and particularly true for a poet who's working broadly in a kind of romantic tradition where language wants to take off, wants to, you know, express its own possibilities, its own exuberance. So something that gets left behind, I think, in poetic sensibility, Stevens is saying, is plainness, ordinariness. And I think the late poems are all about trying to draw that into language. And it's actually a very hard task. Because as soon as we speak, we're employing the resources of language. Mm-hmm. You know, metaphor creeps in, all kinds of figural forms of speaking creep in.
Which is what he acknowledges, doesn't he, yeah. in the next verse. Perhaps we could read that.
Sure. So, it is difficult even to choose the adjective for this blank cold, this sadness without cause. The great structure has become a minor house. No turban walks across the lesson floors. The greenhouse never so badly needed paint. The chimney is 50 years old and slants to one side. A fantastic effort has failed. A repetition in a repetitiousness of men and flies.
Indeed, it is difficult to choose. And I suppose part of what you do in here, in your consulting rooms, is you are assisting people, giving them a place and a space and a listening ear and encouraging them, I suppose, to choose their adjectives for their blank, the blank hold of that sometimes, you know, when you have a feeling and you're not really sure what it is and you don't really know the word for it, it feels so fundamental to what we struggle with, whether we're writers or not. I mean, we're struggling with that all the time, aren't we?
I think that's true. You remind me really of, you know, my own experience sometimes of the couch and how finding the right word, the right phrasing, could sometimes just be a matter of fumbling around because you want to say it one way rather than another. Precision is always important in some ways, but sometimes it's about less than a preference for precision and more about a kind of absolute urgency, you know, a sense that there's an emotional pressure to find the word and that if you don't, there'll be something catastrophic about it.
Yes, yes. I remember the last time we met, you asked me about David Shields, and you said, oh, he's quite important for you, David Shields. Mm. And I was trying to put into words how important he is for me. Mm. And I was sort of struggling. I was really struggling. And I was very much aware of the urgency to sort of explain it. And I couldn't, in fact, explain it to you. This was this little chat we had. But then afterwards, I had that kind of esprit d'escalier moment, and I thought, I should have said this.
Go on.
This is this is why David Shields is important for me. And I think I would have said something along the lines of, I feel he feels like a kind of father to me.
You know, I think Jean Laplanche says somewhere in one of his books that every great thought is a thought of the thing itself. That's, you know, obviously a kind of common thread running through the history of philosophy, but I think it's something that Stevens absolutely endorses. You know, that Stevens' last published poem is called Not Ideas About the Thing, But the Thing Itself. And I think that in that sense, hunger is a wonderful figure for that yearning. Partly because it's poised between the literal and the metaphorical, isn't it? I mean, you know, hunger, I suppose, is a metaphor, and yet it does feel like, you know, an empty, a pressure of emptiness at the heart of the organism, the wish to make ultimate contact with the thing itself. And I think this poem is full of that.
And the thing, I think the thing itself, certainly us approaching it the second time, I think I said this to you when I realised that the first recording had failed. A fantastic effort has failed, seems suddenly so true.
Yeah.
The first time we talked about this, I'd been in a pretty good mood, and I think I talked about these two stanzas from a place of thinking, from a place of abstraction, whereas I went home and I suddenly had the feeling of a fantastic effort, and it is such a different thing.
Yeah.
To actually feel that, and of course it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'd rather not have felt that a fantastic effort had failed.
Yeah. Yeah. It was painful, wasn't it? And we also managed to laugh about it over email. But I think there was, I mean, it gave back to me so much, though, the knowledge that the recording had failed, because I was left, you know, I think we're both left on a bit of a high last time. And you were, you know, you've alluded already to the difference between, you know, the sort of sense of Friday afternoon release, and here we are, you know, at the beginning of a working week, perhaps a little more defended, a little, you know, less out of ourselves, and the leaves, a lot more leaves have fallen in the interim, and it's got a lot colder. And I think what comes back to me now is that sense of exuberance maybe having pulled us away a bit from the plain sense of things, you know, that not in a sense that, you know, I'm reproaching either of us for, but that it's very hard to stay with this plain sense. It's very hard to stay with this unadorned state of mind. And maybe there's something about having to go back today and sort of, well, we're not trying to recall what we said last time. I mean, we're having a new conversation, but it feels like you have to be more attentive to what is really important, to what really matters in the poem. And I'm just sort of struck by the fact that I find myself a bit more subdued today, but in that in the sense of being a bit more in tune, a bit closer to the texture of the poem.
Is therefore the plain a plain sense of things, or the plain sense of things, is it in some way inextricably connected to loss? You know, the great structure has become a minor house, no turban walks across the lessened floors. It's about a lessening, which seems quite sort of inherently depressing to say, well, you know, a plain sense of things, you can only really get to that state if you've experienced and if you're actually in touch with a kind of loss, a kind of emptiness.
Yeah, but I think there's a nice paradox here. It's maybe worth just bringing in a little bit of Winnicott, because Winnicott's point about infant development is that you are induced, if things go more or less okay, you're induced into a sense of fullness. And in fact, the fullness is an illusion that protects the baby from the knowledge of a loss that has happened from the very first. I mean, he was born into and with a loss. And the mother's task in the first hours and days is simply to protect him as much as possible from that knowledge. And in that sense, yes, of course, you have to experience a loss, and indeed the baby has to be introduced in slow doses to this loss that has actually conditioned him. But I think Stephen's point is that this is not a loss that happens after the fact. This is not about being young and beautiful and full of life and then aging and losing it. In a way, he's saying that the loss, the plain sense of things, is the first condition of things. It's the more fundamental state of the world. So it feels like a loss, as it feels like a loss to the baby, but actually it's more something more like a return. And mm-hmm. he does indeed say we return to a plain sense yeah. of things, not we find ourselves kind of mm-hmm. bereft of what we had mm-hmm. and we're left with mm-hmm. a plain sense of things.
Yeah. And the great structure, which is everything we build, we could call it adulthood, we could call it, you know, it's a great developmental structure of the yeah. personality, everything we build onto the minor house. I mean, it's incredible, that word minor, because of course that also refers back to an infant, doesn't it? Mm. You know, the great, but we carry that minor house within us. Mm. So the two are coexisting. You write, I think you write really beautifully about that minor house. I just wonder if you could maybe read a little bit from your book about, I'm wondering which would be a good one to, you actually use the word house yourself there. I like that passage.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Habituated to thinking of yourself as master in your own house, you're apt to forget that you start life feeling rather more like a stranger to it, that your body, your psyche, and the world around you are first felt as inexhaustible sources of danger. Hunger and your mother's absence warn you that the gratifications of food and love are liable to be lost. The restriction, obstruction, and even the punishment of your wishes and impulses then bring home the perils of desire, and later still you internalize this punitive response to your own desire in the form of what Freud calls a superego. Although associated with earlier and later stages of infancy and childhood, these layers of anxiety continue to operate alongside and interact with one another into adolescence and adulthood. Life will be forever haunted by the psychic and physical helplessness into which you're born and which you're never really allowed to surpass. The infant you'll always be never lets you forget how much you have to be anxious about, how often and easily your experience can exceed your capacity to master it. Mm.
And what really struck me with you reading that after the Stevens was that idea about, you know, you're never really allowed to surpass. Mm. I suppose that's... Is that maybe some of the humility of the plain sense of things, the humility of aging, but also perhaps the humility of people who go through the process of psychoanalysis, that sense of recognizing that, you know, actually there are certain structures, there are certain things, you know, our minor houses, which which you're not allowed to surpass. You might be under the illusion or the delusion that you have, but you're not allowed to.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, the delusion that you have surpassed it is often what brings people to us. This sort of loss of contact with the child that we still and always are. And actually that loss of contact can be quite catastrophic, and certainly, you know, it's common enough to hear that in the consulting room, that someone just doesn't know how to play anymore. They complain about a loss of creative energy, but also a loss of contact with the more ordinary pleasures, laughing, enjoying food, enjoying the ordinary and extraordinary pleasures of the body. And I do think of psychoanalysis as being so much about cultivating a kind of pleasurable immersion in ordinary life. I think because that's probably how it's helped me more than in any other way.
So let's immerse ourselves in the final two stanzas.
Yeah. Yet the absence of the imagination had itself to be imagined. The great pond, the plain sense of it, without reflections, leaves, mud, water like dirty glass, expressing silence of a sort, silence of a rat come out to see, the great pond and its waste of the lilies, all this had to be imagined as an inevitable knowledge, required as a necessity requires. I mean, for me, these are, you know, two of the really great stanzas in modern poetry. And it doesn't matter how many times I read them, they surprise me each time. And I think that sentence, the absence of imagination had itself to be imagined, it's one of the most precise and beautiful paradoxes I know in modern literature. It's so rich. And relates so well to the patient that you were talking about before, who says, "It's as if I've got nothing left in me."
Mm-hmm. So to be able to say, "It's as if I've got nothing left in me," is an indication that one has that left in them to explore.
Yeah. I mean, I do talk in, you know, probably the darkest chapter in the book, I do talk about torture and in relation in particular to Primo Levi and Paul Celan. And that reduction of the human being to a state of zero that Levi and others talk about. And I think there is a point of contact here with what Levi talked about as saving the scaffolding of the human being and the human race, I think he was talking about. But, you know, the repetitious ritualization of washing every morning with, in fact, dirty water. Mm-hmm. Levi talks about this. Mm-hmm. And he sort of berates one of his fellow inmates in the camp for bothering to wash his torso with dirty water. What's the point? And he sort of whines, "We're all going to suffer the same fate anyway." Mm-hmm. But there has to be this minimal gap between the zero state and the point just above it. And the washing is that. The dirty water is that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The mud. The rat. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, the rat. Again, that most rudimentary consciousness. Because we talked about this last time, didn't we?
Mm.
And the rat might have this sort of Beckettian post-apocalyptic quality. You know, that it's the rat that comes out after, I don't know, a nuclear winter. But
and plenty of rats in concentration camps,
indeed.
I can imagine.
Yeah, yeah. Not to mention the language, of course, used to talk about the human inmates of concentration camps. But the rat that we found in the poem last time seemed a bit more benign than that. But this wasn't the rat as a kind of figure of decay or of disgust. But this very plain consciousness that just sees things. And it doesn't... I mean, the thing about human perception is that it's too clouded, too overlain by assumptions and by prejudices and by very inured ways of seeing and thinking. And there is something about the rat that gives to us some glimpse of what it might be like to see stripped of all that overlay, to just see things as they are. And to try and imagine what this great pond, quite unglamorous, muddy, dirty water pond, looks like when you don't impose yourself, you don't impose your whole history and perhaps the history of culture on it, but just let yourself see it.
And is that inevitable knowledge what we mean when we talk about having an insight, when somebody has an insight, perhaps when they're lying over there, with you sitting impassively behind them? Is that inevitable knowledge required as necessity requires? Is that got something to do with that, perhaps?
It could have something to do with it, because it does make me think of the repetitiousness. That in a way, the predicament of being in analysis, of coming week after week or every few days or every day, the predicament is that you find yourself, and again, I write about this, kind of sort of stumbling perpetually into your preferred disasters, and that, you know, we prefer to be caught in the sort of reassuring loop of the way we are, even if it makes us unhappy, even if it means repeating the same mistakes. There is something about breaking that circuit which is so terrifying, because it seems really to kill off the person that you were, to get rid of everything you know. And sometimes it does indeed involve massive changes in external life in order to facilitate that. But I do think that breakthrough moment, you know, it's very far from the sort of Hollywood cliche of the R moment when you unearth some traumatic or otherwise revelatory memory. I think it's a moment when you're suddenly aware of how habituated your thinking and your modes of feeling and your modes of relating are, and are suddenly able to imagine something else, which may not be anything in particular. It's just not being the way that you are so used to being.
So it might even be just imagining seeing the water like the dirty glass through the eyes of a rat.
Yeah, because...
Or through the eyes of another person.
Right, but the rat works because we really can't imagine how a rat sees. In other words, we don't have a content for it. Somehow when I think of a rat seeing, I think of a kind of empty seeing, and I both can and can't imagine it. But I see it kind of, you know, sort of turning its nose around the landscape and registering these impressions. And I can sort of just about think of, or I'd have to say one, I could just about imagine that way of seeing that wasn't already saturated. I mean, this is in fact quite closely related to how Bion asks the analyst to listen when he says, you know, without memory or desire, in an Bion's word, in fact. I wasn't thinking of Bion when I said the word, but it's an unsaturated mode of listening.
As necessity requires.
Yeah.
And I wonder, if perhaps coming to the end of this poem, if I could ask you to actually read the final passage, the final paragraph of your book, because I think it speaks to the end of this poem actually as well. I think it speaks to everything we've been talking about. In fact, I even sort of titled it on the page where I wrote it, "Required as Necessity Requires Necessity."
Great. Okay. So the desire to express your pure naked self, to bring it into the light of day, can only end in frustration, in the feeling that what you most wanted to show remains in the dark. Whoever's reading or listening is liable to make of your words something quite other than what you thought you meant. And yet, I cling to this desire, in the knowledge that private life, mine and everyone else's, is finally incommunicable, that the passage between my inner life and yours is hopelessly treacherous, that most of what I've tried to claw from the interior has been lost or distorted somewhere in the tunnel that separates us. You could say, rightly, that this persistence in remaining in the dark is cause for despair, but also, and equally rightly, that it's our only hope.
And how is it our only hope?
Because it's the only possibility of relating to oneself and to others in a way that is rich and inexhaustible. If you could fulfill that fantasy of communicating yourself intact and fully formed to the other person, you would very quickly run out of things to say. And that is as true for yourself as it is for other people. You know, what would life's project be if you already knew yourself? And, you know, that's one of the reasons we so enjoy the Socratic dialogues, because this adventure that he engages us in coming to know our minds and ourselves, it's always unfinished. There's always a bit left to go, and that's the pleasure of Socratic irony.
Well, as we have done bang on a 50-minute hour, we will unfortunately we're going to have to finish our dialogue there.
Very good.
Thank you so much for doing this again with me.
I'm really glad we did.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Joe.
An extra, extra big thank you to Josh for agreeing to do a second recording, which, although different, felt just as nourishing as the first, maybe even more so, proving all sorts of things which I'll let you muse on in the comments section of the website. Please also do consider going on iTunes and giving me a couple of stars and a nice comment or two. I'm really not at all above that sort of basic ego gratification, and it also brings more listeners to these wonderful conversation shores. Thanks again to you for listening. Bye-bye.
All this had to be imagined as an inevitable knowledge, required as a necessity requires.